Now that we've talked about the building blocks, the amino acids, we can talk about what they combine to form, which of course are polypeptides. And in slide one, we see that process, the formation of a peptide bond, which is why a group of amino acids linked together is called a polypeptide, because there are multiple peptide bonds in that structure. But a single peptide bond joins two adjacent amino acids. And importantly, this happens just one way. Regardless of the amino acids being joined, a peptide bond has to occur, if it's going to occur, between the amino end, the amino group of one amino acid, and the carboxyl group of the next amino acid. So on the left side of this equation, you have two isolated amino acids. They haven't yet interacted. The peptide bond, shown as the magenta coloring here, is between not the alpha carbon. This carbon, of course, is carbon, but it's not the alpha carbon. This is the alpha carbon. The alpha carbon is always associated with the R group. And so we don't know what kind of amino acids these are. This is generalized. R1 and R2 mean the R group of the first amino acid and the R group of the other one, which whatever that is. But that's how you can always identify the alpha carbon. The carbon that's involved in the peptide bond is not the alpha carbon. It's the carbon that's part of the carboxyl group of that isolated amino acid before the peptide bond forms. And the N, of course, is part of the amino group of the next amino acid. And so that CN bond is the peptide bond. And that's a covalent bond, and therefore very strong. This is why proteins have pretty high stability. In fact, if you don't have enzymes and things trying to break them apart, proteins can persist for a very long time, because these bonds are pretty stable. Now notice that in this process, the carboxyl group, and these are drawn at physiological pH, which is why you don't have COH, you just have CO, right? Because it's the deprotonated form, that the citrionic form that I just told you about. But notice that when the peptide bond forms, in order for this carbon to be able to, this carboxyl carbon, to be able to make an additional bond, it has to first lose a bond, because it can't just keep making additional bonds, right? It has to satisfy its valence. So that means you have to get rid of that oxygen that it's presently connected to. And the amino group, which is the NH3 of the other amino acid, well, I guess this one would be the other one, doesn't matter. It's going to have to lose some bonds as well in order to make that additional bond. And so that's why losing two H's and an O is going to create water in this situation. In other words, what kind of reaction does this qualify as? It's a condensation reaction, exactly. What's another name for a condensation reaction? Dehydration, exactly. Because you're taking water out of the situation. It's not water until you're done, but it becomes water because you're taking H and OH out. Those combine to form water. And so now the valence is satisfied, but we have a CN bond, not involving the alpha carbon, but involving the formerly carboxyl carbon. And now these two amino acids are linked. Now, since we name these polypeptides and other groups of amino acids for their bonds, it actually leads to a situation in which we have misnomers, technically speaking. For instance, it is accepted to call this thing that has just been created on the screen a dipeptide. But there's really only one peptide bond when you involve two amino acids, right? So a dipeptide is not really technically correct like disaccharide is, where there are two saccharides. A dipeptide really only has one peptide bond, but the di means two amino acids. Okay. Anyway, putting together two monomers using a dehydration or a condensation reaction is not just a special thing about creating polypeptides or peptide bonds. That's how things are joined together most often in biochemistry, right? That's how you also build string together monosaccharides using glycosidic linkages to make a polysaccharide. Those are dehydration reactions as well. Or when you get together nucleotides to make a polynucleotide, DNA or RNA molecule, that's condensation reaction as well. What is that just the opposite of, by the way? Hydrolysis, exactly. This is a reversible reaction. When you build a dipeptide by forming a peptide bond, you can also reverse that with hydrolysis. Here you have to bring in water so that the splitting of that water will allow H to go one way and OH to go another way, and you have the two monomers left over. But here we're building things up because we want to talk about polypeptides. And in slide 2, we have this would really be qualified as an oligopeptide. Oligo means several, but not many. Poly means many. So when it's not very long, we call it an oligopeptide. Anyway, that's not the point. It's not the overall size that's the point here. What you see in this, the importance of this slide, is that a oligopeptide or a polypeptide has a backbone to it, much like a polynucleotide does, right? In a polynucleotide, the backbone is the sugar phosphate backbone. And remember that does not involve at all the nitrogenous bases. Those are just hanging off of the backbone. They don't contribute to the integrity of that strand. Similarly, the R groups of the amino acids that are used to build a polypeptide are not at all involved in the backbone that holds that strand of amino acids together. It's only the peptide bonds between the carboxyl carbon of one amino acid and the nitrogen of the amino of the other amino acid. And another thing is that once the peptide bonds are formed, these things are no longer amino acids, right? Even though we sometimes talk about them as being amino acids, really they are no longer complete amino acids, right? They no longer have a carboxyl group. You still have a C double bonded to an O, but you don't have that other oxygen anymore. That's been lost as water in the dehydration reaction, right? So what do we have instead of a carboxyl group? Well, yes, but I'm talking about this bond. It's just a carbonyl group instead of being a carboxyl, which is more than just a carbonyl, right? So, technically speaking, we shouldn't be calling these amino acids anymore. Really what they are is amino acid residues, because it's what's left of the amino acid after you take the oxygen and hydrogen away for water. But usually, especially when we start talking quickly, we don't bother to say amino acid residue every time. That is the correct way of saying it. When I talk about amino acids in a polypeptide, I really mean amino acid residues in a polypeptide. Well, slide 3 is just a more generalized way of showing what we just saw on the previous slide. The backbone itself is only because of the peptide bonds, and the R groups hang off of that backbone in not necessarily in a perfectly staggered manner like this, but usually in a staggered manner like that, meaning one R group will be up here and the next one will be down here. Well, the reason that it is usually a staggered arrangement like this, of course it isn't in the final product, because a final polypeptide is not going to remain as a linear structure, right? This is just representing this thing in its primary structure, which means simply the sequence of specific amino acids. when this thing folds up into three-dimensional shape, it's not going to look like this. But anyway, if you consider it just to be linear, there usually is a staggered arrangement of the R groups, which are also called side chains, because of something that I'm going to show you in just a minute in another slide. Slide 4 is just a reminder of what a carbonyl group is. You've already named this. That's what's left after you form the peptide bond, because the carbon here in this carbonyl group was the carbon in the carboxyl group of the isolated amino acid, but it's lost that other oxygen. And now this is connected to a nitrogen of the next amino acid. And so carbonyl groups are important in amino acids, just like they're important in other organic compounds, because of the dissimilarity between carbon and oxygen with respect to electronegativity. In other words, we have a polar bond here, and therefore any given amino acid residue has the potential to form hydrogen bonds with other members of that same polypeptide. And that's going to be important in secondary structure, as we'll talk more about. But that's the general formula for a carbonyl group. Slide 5 shows you some disulfide bridge being formed. And this forms whenever you have multiple cysteines in a polypeptide. Now, if you go back to the groups that we looked at in the previous chapter, cysteine includes sulfur. One, you can see it right here. But the R group of cysteine includes a sulfur. But that sulfur in an isolated cysteine amino acid doesn't exist as just sulfur by itself. It exists in a sulfhydryl group. And so recall from 2 chapters ago that the sulfhydryl functional group, which is very similar to hydroxyl, is SH instead of OH. The reason this is important for protein conformation, which of course in turn is important for protein function, is that if 2 cysteine residues are put into proximity, and so I'm not talking about 2 cysteines that are right next to each other in the chain. They can be anywhere in the chain. But because of folding, if they're brought into proximity, then the 2 sulfhydryls, one from each cysteine residue, can undergo a reaction which qualifies as an oxidation reaction, because each of the sulfhydryls is getting stripped of electrons in the form of a hydrogen atom. So each one loses its H, right? Just like when you pick off the hydrogens of your fuel molecules in cellular respiration, that's oxidation. Here, though, it's not for the purpose of making ATP. It's for the purpose of removing a bond from the sulfur so that it can make some other bond instead. And that other bond that it makes instead is a bond between the 2 sulfurs. Since they both lost hydrogen, they're both able to make a bond, they make it with each other. And that is what we call a disulfide bridge, because there's 2 sulfurs involved. And a disulfide bridge is a covalent bond, and therefore, again, very strong. Most of the interactions between residues of polypeptides are much weaker. They're of the kind that we've talked about before when we just talked about interactions in general. Van der Waals interactions, electrostatic interactions, hydrogen bonds. Those are what form the bulk. I mean, those are what are mostly responsible for giving any given polypeptide its overall three-dimensional shape that in turn gives it its function. Most of those interactions are weak interactions. So in a typical protein, you might have no disulfide bonds. It depends on whether there are cysteine residues in that particular polypeptide. But if you only have a few of them, they are going to be stronger than all the other forces. And so that's going to give a special stability to that polypeptide. All right? So you typically see a lot of these, for instance, in things that need to be very stable or very strong, like hair. There's a lot of disulfide bridges in hair, which is why when you burn it, or if you happen to burn it, it smells like sulfur. Okay, slide 6 shows you these disulfide bonds being formed, but without the actual required bending. So this is not just a very long bond. It just shows you that the two sulfurs of the two sulfhydryls of the two cysteine residues don't occur next to each other in primary structure, the actual sequence. But if this thing bends correctly, this sulfhydryl will be matched up with this sulfhydryl. They can both lose their hydrogen and form the disulfide bond. So in the top, what we're looking at is the fact that a single polypeptide can feature sulfhydryl bonds within itself, as long as there are at least two cysteine residues in it. And so that can stabilize the tertiary structure of a single polypeptide. But also, there's no reason why sulfhydryl groups found in separate polypeptides can't get together and do the same thing. And that's what you're seeing on the bottom, the interaction between the top and bottom chain. Those are disulfide bridges being formed that covalently link two separate polypeptides. So this would occur in certain quaternary proteins, right? Or multimeric proteins, ones that are made up of multiple polypeptides. Well, that's what quaternary structure is. It's the actual arrangement of those constituent polypeptides in a multimeric protein, whether there's disulfide bridges or not. That's what the quaternary structure is. But if there are disulfide bridges actually covalently holding those constituent polypeptides together, that makes the quaternary structure much more stable, just like the tertiary structure of this single polypeptide on the top will be much more stable than it would be without the disulfide bridge. All right, now on to 7. The bluish plane that's drawn there is drawn through the peptide bond. Hopefully you recognize this as a peptide bond, right? This is the alpha carbon of one amino acid. This is the alpha carbon of the next amino acid. And so this is not an alpha carbon. This is the carbon of what was once a carboxyl group of this amino acid. And it's being linked to the amino nitrogen of the next amino acid. So this is the peptide bond. But the reason the plane is drawn the way it's shown in blue is that not just that carbon and the nitrogen that are directly participating in the peptide bond, but also this oxygen connected to the carbon, the alpha carbon of that, and the alpha carbon of the next one, all of those atoms, all of those atoms actually line up in a plane. And in this ball and stick model, if you pretend actually making this, there would be no reason why you couldn't swivel any one of these single bonds, right? Single bonds can be swiveled, but double bonds can't be. In reality, but also in the model form, right? A model, a double bond is made of two things, like two springs or whatever. You can't twist them, whereas you can twist a stick, single bond. And so this implies that a peptide bond can be swiveled, but actually it can't be swiveled easily. And that's because of what's shown in slide 8. Do you need me to go back for a second?
No.
I said two different things. I contradicted myself?
You said it can be swiveled, then you said you can't.
I said it looks like it can be swiveled. I was preparing for the truth. The reason that it cannot actually be swiveled, even though it looks like it can in the ball and stick model, is because of what's shown in slide 8. And this is resonance of the electrons in that carbon-nitrogen bond and the carbon-oxygen bond next to it. So the carbon that is part of the, that was part of the carboxyl, the carbon that's not the alpha carbon, it's part of the CO bond and part of the CN bond. Electrons resonate between the CO and the CN bond. And therefore, you can think of them as being both partial double bonds simultaneously. And so it's not the fact, like it was represented in the previous slide, that the CN bond is just an ordinary single bond that can be swiveled. It has double bond nature because of the resonance, the electrons spending some time in both positions. So the peptide bond actually doesn't swivel. And that actually gives you slightly fewer possible arrangements of these atoms in a polypeptide. But there's still plenty of possibilities left over because there is swiveling at places that are true single bonds, permanent single bonds, which you can see. Well, not actually, the next slide will show that. But first, let's go to slide 9. Since we have a partial double bond, the peptide bond itself, then we have two possibilities, right? Whenever you have a double bond, there are two possible isomers, right? The cis and the trans isomers. Remember these? And cis means same side, trans means opposite side, right? So this pink rod here represents the peptide bond between these two amino acid residues. It's not swivelable, though, because of what we just said. And therefore, it's going to be locked into one of two possible positions, the cis or trans configuration. In other words, the R groups can be on the opposite side of this carbon that's involved in the peptide bond, or the both R groups can be on the same side of the carbon that's involved in the peptide bond. If they're on the same side, that's the cis configuration. These really should be italicized and lowercase, cis and trans, but I'm just picking nits. Anyway, those are the two possibilities. Now, which one is more likely, do you think? The trans, and that's because of what? Steric hindrance, exactly. Steric hindrance refers to getting R groups a little bit too close together. It's too confining to be in the cis configuration, and therefore it's energetically not favorable compared to the trans configuration, which you allow things to spread out. So nearly all peptide bonds in nature occur as trans peptide bonds for that reason. But even, and so that fact also actually makes for fewer overall possible conformations, but still, because of swiveling of the rest of the stuff and because of folding over long stretches, there are limitless numbers of shapes that proteins can make. Any individual protein, though, is going to take on one particular shape most of the time, that being the correct shape. And it's going to take on that certain shape because of interactions that we've been talking about, all those weak interactions and the covalent bonding if it occurs. Anyway, on slide 10, we're seeing a swiveling action that I was talking about. Now, on the left part of this, part A, orient yourself here. Remember that the alpha carbons are always going to be the ones with the R groups. So this is an alpha carbon, this one is, and this one is. These two are not. The peptide bonds are bonds between a non-alpha carbon and a nitrogen. So this is a peptide bond, right? So is this. Those are not swiveling, notice. Those really have partial double bond behavior, keeping them from swiveling. But the carbon-carbon bond, which is within one residue, right? Any individual amino acid has a carbon-carbon bond. the alpha carbon and the carbon of the carboxyl. That's just a run-of-the-mill, full-time, single bond. So that can swivel, like you see here. And also the carbon-nitrogen bond that is also within one residue, because every single amino acid also has a carbon-nitrogen bond joining the amino group to the alpha carbon, that also is an ordinary, full-time, single bond, and therefore it can swivel. Okay, so that's all within one amino acid, and every residue is going to have that same ability to swivel at those two bonds. It's just the peptide bond between residues that doesn't swivel. But because of this swiveling within the residues, that means when you have a bunch of residues hooked together, and a typical polypeptide will be tens to hundreds of amino acids, in some cases thousands, but typical one will be hundreds of amino acid residues. Since you have swiveling possible at every one of those residues, that makes it a very versatile thing. If you think, pretend to make a model, there's a lot of ways you could twist that thing into certain shapes. And so that's what really happens. And it twists into a certain shape that basically is the lowest energy configuration with respect to how things interact with each other within that polypeptide. By the way, the phi and the psi, Greek letters here, just refer to how much swiveling there is. They refer to angles of swiveling. The phi one is the swivel between the carbon and the nitrogen, and the psi angle is the swivel between the carbon, alpha carbon, and the carboxyl carbon. Okay, let's go to 11 then. We're looking at an alpha helix in part A. And an alpha helix is an important motif. A motif is just a repeating theme. For instance, in music, for instance. But a motif in a protein is a not an entire three-dimensional shape. It's a shape just involving amino acid residues in a certain neighborhood of that, a certain subset of that overall polypeptide. And what I'm talking about are parts of what we call secondary structure, right? There's up to four levels, three levels in every polypeptide, every protein. Four levels of protein structure in a quaternary protein, right? A multimeric protein. Let's just quickly review what those levels of structure are. Primary structure simply refers to the specific sequence of amino acid residues in a single polypeptide. And that can be easily represented just by a string of letters, each letter representing one of the 20 amino acids. Doesn't give you any information about the shape, but importantly, whatever that primary structure is, whatever that specific sequence is actually going to determine what the eventual shape will be. And that's why when translation ends, which is an informational process, right? Translation is informational because it takes information encoded in the form of messenger RNA and uses that information to build a polypeptide. When that translation is done, the ribosome is not involved, does not care about what shape that protein is going to be. But you don't need additional information being put into that molecule for it to fold up properly. The information is already encoded in that primary sequence. So the higher levels of protein structure, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary, are all a result of primary structure. It might be hard as hell to predict. So you can have the primary structure of a protein. You can get that straight from the gene indirectly, right? But that doesn't tell you at all what it's really going to look like. It's a complicated thing to figure out. Anyway, that's the primary structure for the entire single polypeptide, that sequence. Secondary structure refers to how just groups of residues, not all of them, just groups of them that are near each other, interact with each other to form repeating structures, substructures. And one of those important substructures is the alpha helix. Tertiary structure, by the way, just to finish the list of definitions, tertiary structure is the overall three-dimensional arrangement of a single polypeptide. And that's why if you have a protein that is made of just one polypeptide, the level of organization ends there. And that's why every polypeptide has all three of those at least. But if you're talking about a multimeric protein, one that is made out of multiple polypeptides that remain as individual polypeptides with two ends to them, but put together in some way because of interactions, then that thing has a quaternary structure as well, which is the three-dimensional arrangement of the constituent polypeptides with respect to each other. So back to this alpha helix that we're looking at in slide 11. You find a lot of these in proteins. You find them in both major kinds of proteins in terms of shape. Proteins can be categorized very roughly into a dichotomy or a two-part way of looking at things. You have what are called globular proteins and fibrous proteins. Globular proteins are more compact. They fold up into a, not a perfect sphere, of course, but something that's compact rather than being very long, like a fiber. Fibrous proteins, on the other hand, are elongated. They don't really bend all that much, as much as a globular protein. I shouldn't say they don't bend. They have the ability to bend, but they don't bend in order to be very compact. And so this has implications on the function of a protein. Fibrous proteins are what you mostly have in structural arrangements, right? Like collagen, for instance, is a fibrous protein. Its purpose is to form structure, to be strong. Most proteins, though, in terms of the number of possible proteins that your genes encode for, are globular proteins, and they have a pretty wide variety of functions. But most enzymes, for instance, I mean, enzymes in general are globular proteins. So are transmembrane proteins that operate either as signal transducers or as channels or carrier proteins. Those are all compact. So that it's not about really being structurally strong. It's about having a certain shape. Well, you'll find alpha helices in both kinds, whether they're globular or fibrous. But like I said, an alpha helix is not the entire polypeptide. It's just a little part of the overall length of that polypeptide. And even though it has a nice regular appearance, this helical arrangement, that doesn't at all mean that the residues that make up this repeating curling are the same. It's different amino acid residues making this up. The R groups can be just about anything. The R groups are represented here by the green balls. Notice that they are not really forming the alpha helix itself. What causes the helical turns is hydrogen bonding that's occurring between the backbone atoms of nearby residues, not the R groups. The R groups are just hanging off of the outside of the alpha helix. All right? So you just have different... These are orthographic projections looking at this thing from various sides. But that is an alpha helix, and that's one major motif that we find as part of secondary structure. So secondary structure involves how many, or whether or not there are alpha helices and how many and where they are. What's another major motif that's part of secondary structure? Beta pleated sheets, right, or just beta sheets, sometimes they're called. We'll look at those in a minute, or eventually, depending on when I stop. But first, let's look at slide 12 and see what I just said in words, in pictures. In an alpha helix, what actually causes that helical shape is hydrogen bonding occurring between residues that are separated from each other, four residues apart within the chain. And so notice each box here is a residue, an amino acid residue. This first box is forming a hydrogen bond interaction, represented by the pink arrow, with the fifth residue. So four residues away is how much it takes for the partially charged oxygen, and this oxygen of the carbonyl group here of the first residue is charged how, or partially charged how? It's partially negative, right? High electronegativity for oxygen means it's hogging the electrons, and therefore this is partially negative. Whereas the residue down here is going to be partially positive, right? Because the nitrogen is hogging electrons from the hydrogen, leaving the hydrogen partially positive, not as negative, in other words. And so these two, if they're brought into proximity, will form a hydrogen bond, just like two water molecules in proximity will. Well, the very next neighbor, or even two or three down, isn't possible for those to form hydrogen bonds because the kink would be too tight. But four down is just right. And that's why this first and fifth will form hydrogen bonds, the second and sixth, and so on, in a repeating coil-like alpha helix. And notice the R groups are not involved in this, which is why they just get sent off to the outside of that alpha helix. Now, what the R groups are, though, really matters, of course, because that affects how that alpha helix interacts with its surroundings, which might be something other than a protein, or it might be actually part of that same polypeptide. So that affects tertiary structure. How the actual alpha helices are arranged with respect to each other is part of tertiary structure. Well, alpha helices are often portrayed as a ribbon model, like you see here. These are useful because it shows you that an alpha helix only is a certain amount of length, whereas the overall polypeptide is the full length. And where an alpha helix ends, there has to be, that doesn't mean there's a break in the polypeptide. There's a continuous strand of amino acid residues. But the parts that, after the helix ends, form various turns or loops that connect maybe to another alpha helix after bending. And this is why in a globular protein, for instance, you know, it's easy to understand how alpha helices could be important for a fibrous protein. You just have very long alpha helices. But in a globular protein, you can have a lot of alpha helices right next to each other, still part of the same polypeptide, because hooking them together are little loops of residues bending so that you have another side-by-side alpha helix. In fact, this is how a typical transmembrane protein operating as a channel is arranged. Several different alpha helices, all part of the same polypeptide, arranged kind of like staves in a barrel with loops connecting them together, so it's all one continuous strand of amino acid residues. But then that ring of alpha helices means that there's an interior to that, which is the channel itself, a hole in the membrane. And in that case, the R groups that are on the outside of that whole barrel will be R groups that happen to be hydrophobic. Why is that appropriate? Right. That's what allows them to have no problem being right around the fatty acid tails of the phospholipids in the membrane. And so that's what actually just buoys or keeps this thing buoyant in the membrane itself. The protein just is floating in there, because if it goes too far in one direction, those hydrophobic R groups are going to be exposed to water on the outside of the cell. They don't want to be there. too far inward, they're going to be exposed to water inside the cell. So they just float in the membrane, but form a hole in it because of the lumen of that barrel that I was talking about. Well, the R groups that are toward the interior will be hydrophilic, because that's a water channel that you're forming through there, right? Water and other hydrophilic things can go through it. And therefore, I have no problem being around polar or hydrophilic R groups. Why don't we just stop? I'll give you a 2-minute break today since I went over last time.